Hey guys, my name is Amy Coonan, and I'm your host for The Town Hall, Rubicon's first and only podcast where we share advice for techies, for earth lovers, and for penny pinchers. As much as I love the sound of my own voice, this broadcast is going to rely heavily on guests who are subject matter experts on everything, ranging from how to get your small business up and running, interviews with some of the brains behind your favorite apps, and even how to remove garbage from outer space. You never know who's going to pop up and join me next in studio, so make sure to subscribe to The Town Hall on iTunes to get our episodes downloaded directly. And if your boss is making you work through lunch or your commute is just too short and you miss something awesome, don't worry, we've got your back. You can check out our blog for recaps, reviews, and all things Town Hall. Hey everyone, and welcome to The Town Hall. Today I am in studio with Jane Mossbacher-Morris, and if the name sounds a little bit familiar, it's because Jane's in our Rubicon family, and her husband is Nate Morris, our CEO, but Jane has her own sustainability journey. She's the founder and CEO of To The Market, as well as a brand new book, Buy the Change You Want to See. Jane, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited. You know, this is a special pit stop. You're doing press. Book's about to come out. But I want to rewind and I want to talk about your career and your background. Will you walk me through your personal and professional timeline? And where do you think you sparked your passion for sustainability?
Sure. So I started in a totally different industry. My first job that I actually started in college was I worked in counterterrorism at the U.S. Department of State in D.C. So completely different.
That's crazy.
It was so interesting. I love the issue of counterterrorism. Like, I always describe it as like my first love. Like, I always have this like special feeling for it, like warm and fuzzies. And I absolutely thought I would be working in national security my entire life. But when I started doing more work on the ground around the world, it became more and more clear that job creation and job sustainment in communities that needed economic empowerment was more compelling and maybe more needed than the work that I was doing. And I didn't know exactly what my contribution would be. And so I went on this journey of doing an MBA at Columbia while I was still at the State Department. I left the State Department to go work at the McCain Institute to work on human trafficking. I mean, I really sort of went on this journey of understanding how do I, given my skill sets, add the most value to job creation and job sustainment in communities that really need it and want it. And ultimately, it led me to creating this business, To The Market, which is focused in the retail industry. And we connect ethical suppliers of apparel, accessories, and home goods around the world to some of the biggest brands, corporations, and retailers in the world. So everybody from Target to Bloomingdale's to Dillard's to like corporations like Hilton and MasterCard who have procurement needs as well. And, you know, through this model, we are creating and sustaining jobs in a way that I never would have imagined when I started in counterterrorism.
Can you define like ethical sourcing for those that may be unfamiliar?
So ethical sourcing is sort of subjective in many ways, right? So there's like not like a clear certification that everybody has embraced. The way that we approach it is we think about both people and the planet. So we're focused on how are people being employed? Who is being employed? What is the environment in which they're being employed, meaning like workplace safety? And then from an environmental standpoint, everything from the raw materials that they're using. So are they using upcycled materials? Are they using organic materials? To the chemicals that they're using, to the processes and the manufacturing, to ultimately the delivery of the goods. So it is really broad, but we try to do as much as we can, both focused on the social and the environmental.
I'm a huge online shopper. It's become like a problem in my relationship. It really is. And last night I was on the couch with my fiance and I was doing some research and I was on the To The Market site and I was looking through some of the jewelry. And like I took a couple notes because I was in the artisan incubator and I put like so many different things in my cart and I was looking at the sidebar. And obviously, if you've ever shopped online, especially for clothing or, you know, accessories, you can see where it says shop by size, you know, sort by brand. And you guys have something really unique. You have, you know, sort by cause. That was just something I had never seen before. How do you connect with the different causes and the foundations and the survivors? Like, how do you pick who to have in the artisan market?
So our artisan incubator, which is our direct-to-consumer website, is, I think, a really important part of our business model. It's a small part of our business model. So the vast majority of the work that we do is actually tapping into ethical suppliers to connect them to brands and retailers.
Right.
But the artisan incubator is this awesome direct-to-consumer marketplace, which allows earlier stage artisan groups who maybe don't have the ability to produce in mass for a brand or a retailer to have the opportunity to sell goods that can be purchased by you and I, like from our living room.
I know, I got a necklace.
All right, I love it. So when we think about the causes, we as a business are really focused on how do we bring non-traditional suppliers to the US market? And oftentimes that means that these are suppliers who have not had the opportunity to participate in a global marketplace in the past. And they tend to have a value or cause associated with them that we think is really important to highlight. So it could be that they are specifically empowering women in a community where women have very few economic opportunities. Or it could be a function of, you know, this group being hyper-focused on employing parents who are at risk of having to give up their children because they can't afford them. So we call that orphan prevention. And we like to highlight those in our artisan incubator because we feel like people can shop by their values. And really, that's the premise of the entire book, is this idea that we all spend money every single day on everything from like little gifts for ourselves or for others, but as well as like food, beverages, groceries. And we have the opportunity to shop our values, meaning that if I deeply care about, let's say, you know, American job creation and sustainment, I can find clothes, for example, or products that are made in the USA. If I feel really strongly about women's economic empowerment, I, as an individual and as someone who works in a business or a nonprofit, can decide that I specifically want to find women-owned businesses. So it's this idea that we should be shopping our values because that is a way that we can vote with our wallet every single day.
I love that. I love shop with your values. And that's, like you said, that's the premise of the book. So let's get into the book. There's a lot to discuss. I have a lot of questions. The book's called Buy the Change You Want to See, Use Your Purchasing Power to Make the World a Better Place. It's a long title. It's a good title. When did you start writing the book? Has this really been like a labor of love?
So the book is such an unusual journey as well, much like counterterrorism to retail.
so walk me through that.
Yeah. So when I started to the market, I had a literary agent who was a friend of mine approach me and say, have you ever thought about writing a book? And my answer was no, which is super interesting because like my husband, Nate, I tend to be like super ambitious and have like all of these plans for my life about what I want to accomplish. But writing a book was just like not on that list. And so when she presented this opportunity or made the suggestion, it really planted a seed for me. But my answer at that point was like, no, thank you. I don't have anything I want to say just yet that I want to exist like forever and ever. Amen. But a couple of years later, I realized that this idea of making change through your purchasing power, like it was so simple, but wasn't being talked about enough. And I felt compelled to get that message out. And so I ultimately decided to write a proposal with Wendy Paris, who is another author who worked with me on the book. And ultimately Penguin Random House, you know, bid on the proposal and won. That was probably 6 months after we started working on the book proposal. And then the manuscript was due, gosh, maybe 8 to 9 months later. And then, you know, the book comes out a year later. So when people are thinking about doing a book and they want to go through sort of a traditional publisher, I would caution them to know that like, if you turn in your proposal today, your book is probably not going to hit the shelves for like 2 years. So it is a journey.
Yeah. And, you know, you touched on it a little bit about how the concept was so simple, but no one was talking about it. But what really inspired you to write the book?
I really feel like people feel overwhelmed by some of the challenging things that happen in our world, both socially, environmentally, I mean, in every which way. I mean, we are more connected than ever. Social media, like news, brings us information about like tragedies that are happening all over the world. And because we have this new information, I think it is like so overwhelming, and it can lead to analysis paralysis, and it can lead ultimately to us feeling like there's nothing we can do to make a difference because the problems are so big and they feel so far away. And, you know, in many ways, I would feel that way sometimes. Like I would feel like I would be looking, you know, on Facebook at like news, or, you know, certainly when I was working in counterterrorism and I was sort of tracking things that were happening around the world that were like pretty icky, I just, you know, could feel like, gosh, like what can I possibly do to make a difference? But when I feel that way, the thing that makes me feel inspired and activated again is to think about like, what is within my control to do right now? And ultimately, when I came to the conclusion that it was around harnessing my purchasing power for good, I thought, gosh, like this should be, I want everybody to know that this is an untapped superpower. Like we all, I very rarely meet somebody who is not interested in making some positive contribution, like to this planet, to other people, period. Right. And for people to have that unlock, like was something that I felt really strongly about getting the message out about.
Like most sentences out of my mouth, this one's going to start the same way. I was looking on Instagram.
Great.
And I saw that you recorded the audiobook version of the book. And I live like far from the office, and I'm listening to audiobooks in and out all the time. And I'm so curious whenever I listen, like, what is that process like? Do you have to sit there the whole time? Do you take breaks? Are you drinking water? What if you mess up? Like this, like, we could have talked about this before the show, but I really want to talk about it. That is so interesting to me.
It was such a hilariously wild experience. I mean, when Penguin Random House reached out and was like, are you interested in recording the audiobook and being like the voice on it? I was like, are you sure you don't want to hire like a professional like actress to read this? And the feedback that they gave me was like, no, like we want the authentic voice of the author. And so I agreed to do it. I flew out to LA to Penguin Random House's audio studios, and you literally sit in a recording studio for days. It took me 3 full days. Like sitting all day in the studio, and you are reading your manuscript. And if you mispronounce a name, or sort of the cadence of the sentence that you read isn't natural or right, you have to redo it. And I like, oh my gosh, I have like so much respect now for voiceover actors. Like it was exhausting. It was amazing. And I'm so grateful for the opportunity, but you literally are sitting there with like cough drops and like hot tea and honey because you're just talking and talking and talking. And gosh, it was a wild experience, but I'm super, super glad that I did it.
I know. I was so curious like about what that looked like behind the scenes. That looks so cool. You actually talk about Rubicon in the book. Can you give the listeners like I guess it's not even really a sneak peek. You know, how do you use Rubicon as one of the examples of businesses that are, you know, using our powers for good?
So I have been so super inspired by watching, you know, my husband, Nate, and watching what he has done with Rubicon, where he's taking, you know, using the private sector to have a huge impact on a social justice issue, on an environmental issue. And one of the chapters in the book is really about sort of how do you have specifically a positive impact on the environment as it relates to sort of transactions, meaning like businesses you hire, products you purchase. And the narrative that's in that, you know, in that chapter is really a reflection of me hearing Nate talk about how Rubicon is finding all of these really creative solutions to taking what used to be waste and finding new purposes for them. So like creating revenue streams through recycling initiatives. And it really made me think, gosh, like there's such a parallel here with so many of the products that we buy where, you know, we could be buying more upcycled materialed goods, meaning like I could be buying blankets that are made out of upcycled material, or I could be, you know, buying, like, now there's all these like super cute activewear brands that are using recycled plastic bottles, like in the material. And it sort of like forced me to dig deeper in thinking about how are we to the market, which does like a tremendous amount of retail manufacturing. How are we like digging deep into upcycling, like within our own supply chain? And so it talks about how Rubicon has inspired me into the market to really dig deeper and think about, like, you know, we had initially really focused a bit more on the sort of social piece and sort of the individuals in the supply chain rather than the planet. But like, I really realized that, gosh, like, we need to equally be focused on our environmental impact, because retail manufacturing, the fashion industry, is sadly one of the most polluting industries in the world.
Yeah, we talk about textile waste a lot, and the numbers like really are beyond shocking. And I think that that's just one of the like many facets, whether it's sustainability, social action, you know, millennials, and that's our audience. Our audience is millennials who want to do better for the planet, but may not necessarily know where to start. And you mentioned it earlier, it's overwhelming. You know, these problems seem so big. You know, we think that, you know, we can have an impact, but, you know, probably not the impact that we want to have. And I know that in the book, you share some of those tips and tricks, some of those insights. You know, what are some of the small actions, the low hanging fruit, some little consumer behavioral changes that people can make right off the bat?
So I think it's all about the micro change. Like, I feel like these like massive lifestyle overhauls, it's sort of like dieting. It's like, if you do this sort of like drastic lifestyle change, it is really hard to sustain for your entire life. And usually it backfires, and then you're like, forget it. Like, I'm not doing anything. And so I'm all about the micro change. And so some of the ones that I've made, like, as I've learned more about the space, one of like my favorites, because it's totally free, is learning to say no. And examples of learning to say no include like learning to say no to like tissue paper when I go shopping. And sometimes even like the bags that like they might put the clothes or like the products in. I order food all the time. Like, I am like a terrible cook. And so like, I need other people to help me eat. And so I like sadly order all the time. And I have a note in like my Uber Eats, my Postmates account, like, do not bring me silverware. Do not bring me silverware and napkins. Like, I don't need them. I'm eating at my house. Like, I have silverware that I can use. Right. So sometimes it's literally just like saying no to things that you fundamentally don't need. We've just been conditioned to have them because we're so like fortunate that they're available, but like, we don't need them.
Right. In addition to a lot of the things that you talk about in the book in terms of like what we can do, you also share a lot about your own personal journey and insights and anecdotes about what you've seen and experienced when you've traveled different countries and, you know, seen the work of these causes like firsthand. And I do hate to put you on the spot, although I'm going to literally play a game with you in a couple of minutes where I'm going to put you on the spot.
Great.
But like, what's one thing that you saw, a person you met, something you experienced that motivated you to really kind of begin or continue all of this work? Because it's really unique work. Not everybody's brain works this way.
I think one of the sort of fundamental moments that happened for me when I realized that I needed to start a business that focused on job creation and sustainment for communities that traditionally have been overlooked was I was doing some work in Afghanistan when I was still working in counterterrorism. And we were running this leadership program for women in Afghanistan who, as you can imagine, have just extraordinary challenges at every level. And we were having lunch with some of the women that were in the program. And these women were actually working for the Ministry of Interior. So the fact that they were working and that they were working for the government meant that they were like from like pretty progressive families in itself. Right. And yet, like, as the conversation went on, it became increasingly clear that, obviously through translation, that some of the sort of basic decision-making in the household was still like very much so not their own. And meaning like I remember them being like a little bit like surprised when we were talking about eating and like me sort of asking them questions about like, do you like what, like, how's your meal? And like, do you like eating this? That it occurred to me that like, that wasn't something that was often asked of them. Like, do you like what you're eating? Which is like so basic.
Right.
Like, do you enjoy like what we're having for dinner and, or, you know, lunch at that point. And in, as I sort of began to peel back the onion on that, it became increasingly clear that, you know, without access to economic resources that either like you are earning, like as an individual, or you are maybe sharing with like your spouse, or maybe you're inheriting from your family, without access to those resources, like you don't actually have a lot of power, like, because you can't oftentimes make basic decision making. Like, you can't necessarily, if you don't control purse strings in some way, shape, or form, you can't say like, this is what I want for dinner, because you're not buying dinner. It's not your money. And so like, it's right. So simple. But to me, I was like, oh my gosh.
My mom used to get so mad whenever I would like suggest or be like, I think we should have this. Be like, well, I'm cooking, I'm paying, this is what we're having. You don't think about that often.
Totally. I mean, but it's like, I'm guessing you said that like when you were a child.
Yeah, when I was like, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but that's like what the dynamic is actually for, not to go on like a women's economic empowerment tangent, but like for women around the world who aren't necessarily treated as equals,
right.
Who don't necessarily have the ability to earn, inherit, or share money. They're literally like children for life. It's like, right. You have to ask for things. And I fundamentally believe that like, that is a like supreme injustice, that totally. Everybody should have access to the ability to earn, to the ability to share, to the ability to inherit. And so when I had that realization, it really cemented. And again, in Afghanistan, that this sort of clicked. I was like, I have to be a part of job creation and sustainment for vulnerable communities. And within our supply chain, 99% of the people in our supply chain are women.
That's incredible. That's a really moving statistic. We're not done yet, but before I let you go, let's play rapid fire. I'm going to shoot off just 10 really quick, easy questions. Just say the first thing that comes to your mind, okay?
Sure.
If any actor, dead or alive, were to play you in the movie of your life, who would you cast as yourself and why?
I totally love Betty White. Like, I love
Yesterday
her,
was her birthday.
So much. I know she turned 97.
Yeah.
I love her so much. I would cast Betty White because I think she is an eternal optimist, and I am an eternal optimist. And I think she's funny as hell. And I would like hope that I think I'm funny. I laugh at my own jokes. So like, I would totally love for Betty White to play me.
What is the first thing you do when you get up in the morning?
Drink coffee. Oh my God. I'm so, so useless without coffee. I mean, I am like a coffee addict in its truest form.
What's your go-to karaoke song?
You know, I recently was in, you know, this accelerator Techstars with Target, and I was with like a bunch of other male CEOs, and we would karaoke a lot. And I started getting into Sonny and Cher.
Okay.
Yeah. So
you got to do a duet.
Yes, totally.
Who's the last person that you texted?
I text my husband like all day. Like Nate gets like 9,000 texts from me all day, blow by blow. So Nate.
Where's your favorite place that you've ever traveled? Business, vacation?
Disney World.
Really?
I have literally been all over the world. Disney World is my favorite place on the planet.
Wow. You went to Columbia for business school. Where's the best pizza in New York?
Oh my gosh. That's like such a tough question. Oh. I don't, you know, like New York, I am like so not a like go out for pizza person.
Well, I know you're not cooking it.
No, I'm not. And you know what? I order Domino's like all the time, which is really sad. But like I have like free pizzas that I earn because of the number of pizzas that I earn, like that I order. And so like I could be in any market and like Domino's is coming to my house.
So Jane Morris's favorite pizza in New York is Domino's.
I know. I know when I'm like back in the city, everyone's going to be like, you suck. But I love it.
If you were to start your own talk show, who would your first guest be and why?
Oh, probably my mom, because I think she's like so smart and pretty and awesome. And I love talking to her. And we have like a really fun time. Probably her with my sister, because we just laugh and laugh and laugh.
What's the scariest thing you've ever done?
Scariest thing I've ever done. You know, I don't know. I don't really get scared. Like, I think it was just sometimes like a bad thing. I think I tend to be super, super, super even keeled. And then I also sort of don't put myself in situations that I think are unnecessary risk. But like, again, I've traveled to war zones. And so it's not
that. Yeah, that's up there.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like when it, like, I have the attitude of like, when it's your time to go, it's your time to go. Like, mm-hmm. be as thoughtful as you can about your own security and your own choices. But I don't know. I know that sounds so stupid, but I don't really get scared. I think for me, actually, like, being scared is not situational. It's the amount of pressure I put on myself. Like, that's like what scares me, is if I'm going to live up to the expectations that I set for myself.
What is one piece of advice that you'd give to a budding female entrepreneur?
Persistence and knowing that it is like pushing a boulder like up a mountain. I mean, it is, starting and running a business has unquestionably been the hardest thing I have ever done by a country mile. I mean, it tests your confidence and your sense of self almost on a daily basis. I mean, it is really, really tough. And so I would say, like, know that people are going to brush you off, that they're not going to value you potentially the same way that they should, but you have to be your own best advocate and you have to believe in yourself. And just keep working.
And lastly, what does success mean to you?
To me, success is creating value. So if I have created value for people in our supply chain, if I've created value for the people that work for the business and for our shareholders who have invested in the business, to me, like, we have unquestionably succeeded.
Guys, Jane's book, Buy the Change You Want to See, Use Your Purchasing Power to Make the World a Better Place. By the time this drops, it's available now wherever books are sold, and go check out To The Market for gorgeous handcrafted products for the artisan. I mean, I really cannot get over the artisan space that you created, and read more about the people and all of the causes, and let's be conscious consumers together. So Jane, thank you so much for coming on and hanging out and making this really gross, rainy Friday that much better.
Thanks for having me.